your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Hello, everybody. Surprise! It's an unexpected bonus edition of the Microbrew Podcast, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, as usual. Kurt Hoag, as usual, is on the other line. And also, Spencer Michaelis is here. Special guest Spencer Michaelis. You may know him from his various writings around the internet. It's true. Brewer Fanatic is where you might find him. He is, if you're into local college, he's the pitching coach at Wisconsin Lutheran College. But for our purposes, a student of the Milwaukee Brewers minor leagues, which is what we are here to talk about today. Yes, the Brewers just took 3 of 4 from the Cubs. We will still talk about that in our normal place, but this is specifically geared toward the minor leagues. And at the end of this conversation, I actually had a chance to chat with the Nashville Sounds play-by-play announcer, Jeff Hem. So talk to him about some of the guys at Nashville, including Aaron Ashby, who isn't so much a prospect anymore as, you know, kind of part of the greater Brewers universe. Tyler Wasner, Carlos Rodriguez talked about the challenge system in the minor league. So there's a lot there. That was a fun conversation that comes up after this. But yes, we are here to talk minor league baseball. Spencer, how you doing, man? Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. What's going on with you tonight?
I'm doing well. Got to attend the last 2 Brewer games, so those were fun. And took off of work today for that, so that was even more fun. And I'm doing well. It's finally things have slowed down a little bit now that our college season is over, so I finally have some time to do stuff like this.
Very good. Did you boo?
Oh, that's a good question.
I booed.
That's fantastic.
As is within your right, some would say.
Yeah.
Including the man you booed.
Yeah. Yo, he told me I could. So, yeah, I figured I'd listen.
He said you could. However, I would like to say to people, I would prefer you not to boo me in public. Ever since council has, you know, given people license to boo, like it's just been happening to JR and me. So please stop that.
In a way, this is the worst time to do this because obviously people are going to want to hear more about the Cubs Brewers series. We will be talking about it, but I wanted to focus on this. It's a good moment in time, 2 months into the season, to discuss what's going on at the minor league level. Obviously we're still a good 2 months away from the trade deadline, but that'll pick up steam then, I suppose. I want to talk about this in parts. I want to talk about the top prospects, of course. I want to talk about it in terms of guys who could still help the Brewers this year. And then where I feel like we get into Spencer's specialty is talking about guys that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path, not top 5 guys per se, but guys that we really want to pay attention to. Craig Yoho, which we've already talked about at length. He is a huge, we are huge fans apparently of Craig Yoho on the pod. And the first place I want to start is with a guy who's actually pitching as we record this on Thursday night. It's Craig Yoho. No, oh man, I got Craig Yoho on the brain. It's Jacob Mizorowski, the number one prospect in the organization. Kurt, you messaged me as I was on my way to getting here and said he was shoving tonight.
Have you seen the tweet that I sent out?
No, Kurt, I am very, very behind. I am still fielding messages from my son who left all his gear at his baseball game.
Oh, so well, I'll let Spencer get to this, but yeah, there was a video there. I posted out a video of like the most disgusting swing at a slider I've ever seen in professional baseball. Jacob Mizorowski was just obliterating fools this evening.
And that's good, but he's also walked some fools and he's given up some hits.
Okay, well, that's so that's part of the context on it.
It is 100% the context.
They called this swing a ball and not a swing, and there was a walk, and that led to a run. So tonight, I don't think it's really been an issue, but it has been this year, yes. Anyway, with that, I'll cede the floor.
Here is my issue. I mentioned this on a previous pod. I think he's a reliever now and forever, Kurt. And you don't agree with me. I would love to hear where Spencer comes in. And then Kurt, you can also add your two cents. I think he walks too many guys. And I get the feeling the Brewers, if they had their druthers, would use him at some point this year. That certainly cannot happen in a starting capacity. And I wonder if they bring him up as a reliever, if that toothpaste can ever go back into the tube for a guy like him, who's still going to need so much work to get to a point where he's not walking the ballpark, in addition to making everybody swing and miss and throwing 103 miles an hour. So, Spencer, the floor is yours. Tell me what you think about as you think about Jacob Mizorowski.
So I guess I would say I agree with both of you to some extent, because I do think I would put like a timeline on his starting pitching ability in the majors to be like at least almost 2 years out. I don't know that he's even all that close if you want him to be a starter long term. But like JR said, I think he could pitch out of the pen soon with the type of stuff that he has, especially later in the season when the rosters expand and everything, and you have a chance to bring in a guy who could be kind of an elite arm the moment he steps into a major league pen. But on the starting side of things, if you can get him to be a starter long term, the value is obviously much, much higher than what you're going to get out of the pen. I do think there's a chance that there's kind of a Josh Hader situation where he comes up in the pen and they just realize he's so good in this role, it's not worth us pushing him back into a starter role at any point and trying to figure it out. And it might be kind of hard to stretch him back out. This is a guy who's taken a long time to get stretched out, even to the point he's at right now. So if they do end up bringing him up in the pen role, I don't know that they can put that can of worms back in the can. Like, I think that might be hard to restart. So we see him this year if they're fine with him being a reliever long term, and I think we might not if they actually truly want him to start long term.
So tell me what you think about this, because I think I agree with everything you're saying about Miz for sure. Like, and I just did my own like updated prospect rank for myself, and like my little blurb on Miz was like kind of disappointed that the command hasn't taken any strides forward. Like, they haven't seemed to find the repeatability in that delivery yet. But the thing that keeps standing out to me is like, he doesn't give up hits. And I'd be curious your take on that, because like at the end of the day, if you're limiting hard hits and damage, that you can live with the walks a little more. But you know, whether it's as like a prospect evaluator or as a coach or thinking about like how that translates to the big leagues, I'd be curious as to your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think honestly, I would lean towards, I'd rather have somebody walking people than giving up tons of hits. If you have to choose between one or the other, there's less damage done on a walk. There's really no ability for damage unless it's a bases loaded walk, obviously. But I do think he's getting to a point where we're talking almost a batter an inning, and that gets pretty tough to actually just work with that at the major league level. We've seen even with a guy like Abner Uribe, who I would say is a step below Mizorowski stuff-wise in a lot of ways, but even he does have the velo, he throws really hard, he's got pretty decent stuff, and even beyond the walk issues, if you're just missing over the middle of the plate against major league hitters, that velo becomes less valuable as to what a double-A hitter might do against a mistake 99-mile-per-hour fastball. Like, they're just more likely to miss that pitch just because it's a lower level of talent. So I would say I would rather he be the way he is right now, where nobody's really hitting him and he is just having walk issues, but I still think it could be a problem at the major league level.
I've been visualizing a world where by season's end, it's McGill, Mizorowski, and Devin Williams at the end of the bullpen. Now, that's extremely optimistic because it implies that Williams is fully healthy. It implies that McGill, who got hit, you know, smoked by a liner earlier this week, is healthy. And it implies, of course, that Mizorowski gets to the big league level. And maybe I'm wrong in thinking that he's definitely going to be a candidate to be a reliever. Like, I know coming into the year, they thought that. Even maybe late last year, they thought that. But with the way the season has transpired, which is, again, it's not bad. He's got great tape and, you know, like great results in many cases, but I wonder if they aren't expecting, because their bullpen is good, right? Like, Brian Hudson came out of nowhere to become really important, and they've got guys, you know, and Nolly Paredes has just shown up and is starting to hurl. I mean, it feels like they've got guys right now and don't need that specialty hammer, at least right now.
I still think I'll jump in on that. I think it happens just because they wanted it to happen last year. They really did. And it, I mean, the arm fatigue ended up happening with Miz, but also like the jump to double A happened and it did not happen good for him. Like he was hitting a guy in an inning. But yeah, you get into the questions like Spencer said, well, actually Jer, like you said it first, like the toothpaste back in the tube. Like, is it stunting his development as a starter, which you want for him long term, to go reliever, big league pennant race in the middle of the year? Like I could see it both ways. I could see that being something that helps the kid figure it out too. And then you throw him back in as a starter, like in the offseason into spring. So I still lean yes. Like Matt Arnold loves Velo. I'm pretty sure he was in Tampa Bay when David Price came up as a rookie. So like, I think they want to make it happen.
Yeah, that's a really good point with the David Price of it all. So Spencer, I don't want to just sort of the last word on Mizorowski before we go to some of these other guys. He's now kind of the unquestioned number one prospect in the organization with Jackson Chourio graduating. Beyond that, some of my reliever skepticism is I'll be honest, Keith Law, guy I really trust. He's been wrong a lot, but he's right a lot too. And he's been on Miz as a reliever from the word go. How good are we talking here? Like let's say best case scenario, he does develop even as a starter, but let's picture him as a reliever and he's dominant. You know, is this like a one of a kind reliever? Is he as good as Josh Hader? Is he slightly below? Like how do you have anything to compare him to?
Mason Miller, honestly, is an interesting comp in some ways. I can see some of that. Now, he has two breaking balls, whereas Miller only has the slider. But that's the type of arm I think you could see in shorter stints. And Miller they tried to start him with the A's last year, and it didn't go super well. It went fine, but I think he had some arm issues and a lot of things were going on. But he's clearly taken to the closer role really well, and that's the type of arm I think you could see somebody in that type of setting could just sit triple digits. And it's not just triple digits. It's huge extension. It's a good shape. It's got crazy low release height for somebody who's 6'7". Like there's a lot of good things with the fastball, even beyond the velo. So in shorter stints, I think you could be talking about arguably the best closer in baseball if he's at least throwing enough strikes.
Awesome.
You're talking about Craig Yoho.
We are going have patience. We're going to talk about Craig Yoho. As we record this, Craig Yoho was promoted.
Big summer blowout
to Double A Biloxi. Craig Yoho and Jacob Mizorowski are now teammates. They will be Brewers by the end of the year. Book it. That is what Kurt feels. Okay, that's not actually what we're saying.
It is. If a reliever is at Double A and he's got a legitimate plus pitch.
Yeah. He's like Yoho's changeup, for example.
I mean, we saw it with Abner. He's not far. With Miz right now, he could come up and pitch in the bullpen. He's not far.
All right. Okay, so now it's Yoho, McGill, Mizorowski, Williams to close down games. That's where we are at. Assuming health, assuming miraculously everything goes exactly according to plan. The rest of the Brewers sort of top five is populated by guys that I don't know if we're not really going to talk much about. Jefferson Caro, of course, the catcher who tore up his shoulder very early in the season, first game of the season, I believe. He's out for the year. Tyler Black, we've seen. I think Brewers fans have kind of gotten to know him a little bit. Still, you know, has some issues to work out defensively and you know, probably offensively too while he's at it, although he has pretty much been awesome with the bat at Triple A. He'll be here again at some point this season. Robert Gasser is here. He's pretty much a cemented member of the rotation by now. And that leaves us with my favorite prospect, the one and only Brock Wilkin. Third baseman, first round pick last year. He is currently at Biloxi. He got hit in the face with a pitch earlier this year. That is a bummer. He came back after a few weeks. He was wearing a mask. He's hit a couple home runs, but the offense has been meh. It has not been to the level to justify my adoration for the idea of having a corner, a third baseman who could just mash at the big league level. It's all I want in life right now, guys. Spencer, what do we make of Brock Wilkin's season so far? Is this a step back or is it just, hey, the kid is playing at Double A? You know, he's already been pretty aggressively moved up the system. Maybe this is nothing to worry about.
And he got hit in the face.
Oh, he got hit in the face. That's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, so I will say, since he's come back from getting hit in the face, he is carrying a 128 WRC plus. He's hit those four homers. The Southern League is a mess for a hitting environment right now. I mean, it's a 700 OPS is, I believe, getting you to 100 weighted runs created plus right now. Like, it's bad. So he's got a 760 OPS since he came back, and he looks fine to me. I think there was a bit of an adjustment at first when he came back. His strikeout rate in that time is only 23.6%. So that's in a fine spot for somebody with the type of power he has, and an 8% walk rate. Those first few games weren't great. He looked uncomfortable. He is wearing the full mask, which is something you really don't see people do. I'm sure there was an adjustment period for that when he was stepping into the box with that. I don't know. I mean, the bat to me is not a concern, and I'd say he's played better defensively at third than I expected him to since he was drafted. So I don't know if Joey Ortiz's 870 OPS isn't enough for you at third base, but Brock Wilkin is. I do think Wilkin's going to hit, and I'd expect those numbers to go up a bit, but the Southern League is crazy right now. It's just really pitcher heavy and not great for hitters.
I did not anticipate that Joey Ortiz would hit this well. That's true. I also view Joey Ortiz as a shortstop who's biding his time until somebody, until a masher can get to third base. Joey, look, no questions asked. One of the surprises of the season is how great Joey Ortiz has been, or at least one of the high points of the season. I don't know if it's a surprise. Kurt, I came into the year wanting Brock Wilkin to be the starting third baseman by 2025. I thought he might actually be here in 2024. I don't really think that anymore. Getting hit in the face definitely sidetracks that trajectory to some degree, but maybe that it was always good, aggressive and ambitious. You think he's a starting third baseman in 2025?
Get ready to learn Andrew Monasterio, buddy.
I already did that. This is already the second year. I love Andrew. You know, we love Andrew Monasterio, but come on.
So I've bought into your Brock Wilkin Kool-Aid a little bit. We did the ranks. He's third Kool-Aid for me now, which like still feels too high. Like in my head, I'm not that high on Brock Wilkin, but like that's the grade I gave him when I did my grades. So he's third. So I still think, yeah, we see it, like the defense, right? Spencer might be okay enough to try it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's a lot better than like Tyler Black at third, I would say.
Yeah, okay. So, and I think Tyler Black might actually be better at third than first, but that's a story for a different day. Really? It's not good at first, JR.
Oh, no. It's that is an indictment. Oh, no.
I want to see Tyler Black in the outfield. I've been on that train since like he actually was in the outfield and then got hurt. And
do you know who that might have worked for if somebody had tried it a little more aggressively? Is Keston Hira.
Oh, yes. Yes. Thank you for getting the Keston reference. And also, you're right. Remember when he played left field and made that great catch?
One great
play. Terrible route. If you, no one listening to this remembers that, but I do. And you
do. I do remember.
Probably does too. I'm glad we got our Keston reference in. Good job on that one. Brock Wilkin next year sometime, but I'm not sure about like opening day. I don't see the trajectory to get to AAA is going to take a while at this rate. And they're probably going to want to give him some at bats there, but at some point probably. Yeah.
Okay. So Kurt, you said that he's your number three. Miz is your number one. Who's your number two?
Caro.
Oh, Caro. Of course. Okay. Cause I was, you know, trying to debate which guy I wanted to talk about next. Spencer, was there anything else you wanted to throw in on Wilkin, or was that it?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
I will let you go. I just had some Carolina Mudcat suggestions, but I want to see where you would take this. So you have the floor.
I do have a Carolina Mudcat that I want to discuss. It's not going to be a surprise which one, but I did speak briefly with Jeff Hem about Carlos Rodriguez, who was the minor league co-pitcher of the year last year with Robert Gasser, started out slowly with AAA Nashville and then has come on pretty strongly. He's been really good the last few starts, and I feel like we've gotten to a point where he's going to pitch in Milwaukee this year at some point. I don't know when, and I don't know exactly if he's going to take someone's spot or if he just kind of has to wait for injuries, a 40-man spot to become abundantly available. I don't know the course of action there, but what do we think about Carlos Rodriguez? Kurt, I'm actually going to start with you because I do know you follow him pretty closely and have seen the starts improve a little bit. Where are you at with him?
Yeah, I'm like a mixed bag, honestly. I found myself like I'm much more skeptical than you that we've seen this year. I think the stuff is playing up well right now at AAA. Like he's figuring it out, putting it all together. But like he's what, 21, 20, maybe 22? Like he's still really young.
And let's not forget, they left Gasser there all last year when he was older and ready, you know.
I just think like that big league readiness is not there yet with him. And like ultimately, you know, you kind of like grade out the stuff and it's like nothing stands out and that kind of hurts him a little bit. But this is a guy that's, you know, like he's pitched well at every single level. We've seen like one of the archetypes of pitchers that I like is guys that just like have four or five, like, okay, pretty good pitches. And then they command it. And that's pretty much him. So it should, you know, I think next year we should see him at some point. Plus like do they have to 40 man him this off season?
Oh, I don't think so, but
I don't even think we're at that point yet. I think it's maybe next year. So, I'm not sure we see him this year. I think he's a little lower on the starter depth chart.
Okay, fair enough. Spencer, what say you about Carlos? We should point out Carlos F. Rodriguez, not to be confused with the other Carlos Rodriguez, who's the outfield prospect in the organization.
Yeah, I am on his Fangraphs page right now. It looks like it is this offseason that he does have to
be. Oh, bummer.
Rule 5, but I would imagine they're going to do that.
Oh, yes.
I think Kirk pretty much covered it. It's like 5 or 6 pitches that are all pretty, they're okay. They're not great. Nothing blows you away. He can kind of change the usage from game to game because he has a bunch of different offerings and whatever ones are working for him that game, he can go to that more often. Velocity wise, it's not anything too exciting. 92, 93, maybe a little bit higher on the fastball at times, but I do think you can look at a guy like Colin Ray and see that type of path for someone like him. Now he's got Rodriguez has a big breaking ball curveball that Ray doesn't have, but a lot of the other stuff is pretty similar. He's got the cutter, he's got the sinker and the four seam. Just a guy who mixes all his pitches, throws a decent amount of strikes. He's gotten a lot better in that regard over the last month, started really poorly at AAA in that way. And then it's gotten much, much better, but actually, yeah, the walk rate's 5% in May in his 4 starts. So that's really good. And he can miss bats. It's not like he's just a pitch to contact guy, but you see that with a guy like Ray too, who can get you a strikeout an inning in a good game. Like I think that's kind of the type of pitcher you're looking at, but maybe with a little bit more development left than what you have in Ray, who's pretty much maxed out exactly what he's capable of doing. So that's how I look at him, a guy who could help the rotation. But I do think I'd probably lean towards next season being more likely for him to make his debut as well, because I don't think he's a guy that comes up and like helps out of the pen or anything just because he doesn't have those elite pitches.
All right, before we move on, because we've already used up all the time I promised that we would use up, to go down to Carolina, the Mudcats. There are two teenagers, and I want to know which one I need to be the most crazy, excited, irrational, unreasonable about. We have Yofiri Rodriguez, who has outperformed Jackson Churio at that age. At least he did initially when he came over to the United States for the first time this year. It has not necessarily sustained, but I was pretty excited about him even last year, thanks to Kurt Hoag's nudging there. And then there's Cooper Pratt, a shortstop high schooler that we've talked about a lot, who was a big-time overslot signing in the 2023 draft. I love the 2023 draft. I find myself following guys like Tate Keener, who I probably wouldn't be paying attention to because he was in the 2023 draft. But Cooper Pratt's a guy that they had to really work hard to sign. They did it. And he is already at age 19 playing for the Carolina Mudcats and looking, I would say, comfortable. So Spencer, we'll start with you. What do you think of these guys? Which one should we be crowning the next Jackson Churio, or even better than the next Jackson Churio? I am ready to go all in here, Spencer.
I am not ready to go all in that way for either of them, but Yofiri probably has the higher overall ceiling because I think the bat could be pretty special. He's got some pretty impressive home run power. It's an easy swing. It really doesn't look like he's trying to crush the ball, and then it comes off the bat at 106 when he's 19 years old. Like, that's not super common. But Pratt probably is more polished right now as a player because he's got a much better strikeout rate. He's walking more. both are fine defensively, so I don't know if there's too much to compare there. But Pratt, I think, could move a little bit quicker than Rodriguez, and I think Rodriguez has the higher overall ceiling if I had to place. They're both very interesting, and if Pratt can tap into some power, he's got a very high ceiling as well, but Jofre shows more signs of that, I would say.
Yeah, no, I'm with Spencer on that. And the Cooper Pratt power thing is interesting to me because, like, I see what I think people wanted to see in Bryce Terang's power with Cooper Pratt. Like, that swing could work. Like, he just has really good control of the barrel and, like, a good feel for contact. And you can develop that into power for sure. JR, I would like to, if Spencer would entertain us with this. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being that guy stinks, don't pay any attention to him, to 10 being he's Corbin Burns / Josh Hader reincarnate as a 20-year-old body, run down some of the lower, not lower rank, but mid to lower tier prospects that you'll see in lists right now and see where gauge where your excitement level is for guys.
Sure.
So we'll just, yeah, I'll say the names, and then if you want to give me a number and then a little short explanation, let's do it.
Yeah.
Jer, you can throw some names in here too, but I'll start with Logan Henderson.
Oh yeah. We'll give that a 7. He is partially because I was already pretty big on Henderson, so it's not like I'm going up in too much excitement after his first start for the Timber Rattlers, but I mean, this is a guy who sat like 90 to 92 with his fastball last year. It didn't have great qualities on the fastball either. And this year he's apparently come out. I mean, his first start, he hit 97, but he sat kind of 92 to 95. The reports are that his induced vertical break is up into like the 18 to 20 inch range now, which is very, very good. Means he can get it above bats and it'll help the velo play up a little bit. His changeup is a plus pitch. I mean, it is the best in the Brewer system. It's probably one of the best changeups in minor league baseball.
Craig Yoho does not approve of that endorsement.
Starter wise. Sorry.
Oh.
Yep.
We're good.
Whose do you think is better, Yoho or Henderson?
Oh, they're very close. Yoho's a screwball. I'm calling it a screwball. Like
it's
I call
airbender.
It.
It's an airbender.
Yeah, it looks right. Just like
Kevin Williams. All right, so 7 on Henderson. Let's go with Josh Noth.
I'll go 7 on Noth too. He's looked a lot better lately, I'll say, first of all. This is a guy who hadn't pitched in pro ball before he got to low A Carolina. So his first experience, it took him a little bit of time to settle in, you could tell. But the fastball's in the mid-90s and can get higher at 19 years old. Slider and curveball both have crazy metrics on them. I mean, they're both 3,000 RPM pitches. They move quite a bit. They're very sharp. He doesn't know how to command them yet, I would say. But he can drop the curveball in for strikes and get some pretty bad swing and miss with the slider, especially. So it's 3 pitches that are all show signs of being above average or better from a 19-year-old. And the velo has room to grow. I think he's more just, he's a thrower, not a pitcher right now, to use that cliche. So he's going to be a guy who probably takes a while to move through the system, but the ceiling is up there with most any starter in the system. It's really high.
Can we confirm my prior here that the 2023 draft is going to transform the Brewers organization? Can we just say that?
Are they not already perennial contenders in the division?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
They're going to become the Dodgers?
No, they're going to win several World Series because of the 2023 draft. That's the bar I'm clearing with this group. Sorry. One more names. More names, Kurt.
Okay. Well, you started talking about curveball, so I need to get a take out there. I threw this to JR last week. Yorman Galindez's curveball is what Josh Noth wants to be when it grows up. Maybe that's the command, but oh boy, I think we're paying all the attention to the wrong curveball in this system.
I like that take. Galindez's curve is really good. And he improved his slider this year. He almost throws like a sweeper type pitch at times too, where it almost looks like he's throwing 3 different breaking balls. So he's very fun. And that curve is very, very good. And he can command it really well.
1 to 10 on Galindez.
I'm going 8 because I liked him last year, but he really jumped up this year. Like I wasn't expecting this big because his velo went up 3 to 4 miles per hour this year too. It's been a really big jump for him. So he's exciting.
Okay, rapid fire with a couple names here. Shane Smith, give me a number. He's moved to starter. They're starting him.
I did see that. I was just noticing that today. I give it a, man, I keep choosing seven. That feels unfair, but I'm going seven again because I think he's a guy that could relieve in the majors this year if they needed him to. And as a starter, if they believe he can start, I think the stuff is good. I mean, it's mid-90s, curveball, slider. If they think he can start and he's at double A and he's doing well, pretty exciting.
Okay, Ryan Burchard.
I'll go six because I haven't really got to see him this year.
Yeah, he's been hurt. Yeah. Okay. Last one on the rapid fire.
Yep.
Brett Witkowski. Witkowski, I think. I think that's it.
Yeah. Seven again. He struggled at double A a little bit, but the stuff and the reports on everything are just so, I mean, they're so positive from every direction that, granted, I haven't really gotten to watch him in double A very well because I'm watching it from a very high plate behind the plate view, but the stuff and the slider especially is just really good, and he made huge strides. So
yeah. Javik Blake, if you're listening to this, Shuckers radio announcer, I will pay you $5. I will Venmo it to you right now if we can get that center field camera up.
I'll throw in six. Oh, Spencer's throwing in 10. I'll throw in 10, and now we can at least get two innings televised from somewhere other than the home plate camera. We did it, guys. Okay, I want to shift a little bit to, before we get out of here, guys that could potentially help this year. This is the Craig Yoho part of the program, but I don't want to start with him. I want to start with Bradley Blaylock, a guy who is in double A. Man, it's Biloxi Shuckers rotation. Like, this is so Brewers, traditional Brewers here. All the pitching, none of the hitting right now. I don't know what the deal is with that. But Blaylock was called up, obviously didn't get into a game, went back down. I imagine that he'll be back at some point and contribute this year. I don't know that for sure, though. He's on the 40-man roster, which gives him an advantage over some other guys. What do you know about Bradley Blaylock, Spencer, and do you anticipate he will be contributing this year or even early next?
I think there's a good chance we see him again because he does have the type of stuff that plays well in a bullpen setting if he has to go to that role. It's mid-90s fastball, but he's been up to 23 inches of induced vertical break, which is an insane number. The thing with him, though, is he is very over the top, and with Tobias Myers we kind of saw the same issue where you come really far over the top, that kind of downplays that number a little bit, but it's still so much of an outlier that it could play. And then he's got a really good curveball and a solid slider, and I guess I would say those alternate from game to game sometimes which one is actually playing up that day. But again, that gives him an even better chance of performing if he can just use whichever one feels best in that game. So I think we see him again, and I would think it would be a little bit weird to have started his clock on everything and then not use him at all this season. Somebody that they feel good enough that they went out and traded for him, added him to the 40 man, and were willing to bring him up and use him in a major league game. They must like him a decent amount, so I would imagine we see him again.
Yeah. Kurt, it's Craig Yoho time.
There's no one else you want to talk about that could impact the big league. Actually,
There are more. I just want to get
Wes Clark. You might be right, though. There's not a lot of guys.
We have others that we'll discuss.
They're up here already.
Listen to me.
Okay.
Focus. Sorry. I wanted you to tell me why Craig Yoho, who was in Wisconsin for most of the year as a relief pitcher, why I should be excited as somebody who follows the Brewers, that guy could potentially impact the 2024 team. That seemed very aggressive. He finally has been promoted to Biloxi. I know everyone kind of thought maybe that would be sooner than now, but he is in Biloxi now. Are you still thinking that there is a chance this guy with his devastating changeup / screwball, whatever we want to call it, could be here in 2024?
Well, I can't steal this from Spencer. This is going to be Spencer's floor.
Oh.
I just want to quick say that I got the minor league box scores game cast up here on my other tab. Filippo De Turi singles and steals a base and scores a run. We didn't talk about him, so
we haven't.
Filippo De Turi that has been mentioned. And now I'm just going to pass Craig Yoho discussion up to Spencer.
Yeah, I will first note that I am in the same boat, that I think he could help the Brewers this year if he were to be called up. I think he'd be able to perform. The main reason being the changeup, screwball, airbender, whatever you want to call it. It is just an elite pitch that he commands well. He can drop it in for strikes. He can throw it out of the zone for chase. But the thing, and honestly, the biggest difference between a guy like Devin Williams, who has a really good four seam, but really no other third pitch, he's throwing that cutter at times, but it's not great. is that Yoho throws a curveball and it's actually pretty good. And then he also throws a fastball that has 20 inches of horizontal break. So it just really break. I mean, he's broken a lot of bats. He's gotten in on a lot of hands. He's carrying a 61% ground ball rate out of low A. So while he's also striking out 45 or 48% of hitters, he's also getting the ball on the ground almost every time it's put in play. So every single thing he does is exactly what you want out of a pitcher. I'll throw a couple numbers out that I had. His 45% whiff rate is sixth in all of minor league baseball for anybody with at least 20 innings pitched. His called strike rate is second. His strikeout rate is first. He's only allowed one extra base hit. His ground ball rate, like I said, is 61%. Whip of 0.69 is fourth in all of minor league baseball. ERA is fourth, and FIP of 0.94 is third. So he's been like a top five pitcher by every single metric that you would care about. He's old for the level, but if you see any sign of this continuing at AA, I think the Brewers should fast track him and try and get him into their big league pen, because I think if it shows that it plays at AA, it's going to continue to play.
Yeah, that's the thing with where we are nowadays in pitching, right? It's like, if your stuff is, you know, gets hitters out and it like has those elite traits at AA, you don't really need a whole lot of, I mean, it's the Jackson Churio thing sort of, but he's a rare case for hitters, where maybe more Abner Ribe case.
Like, yeah,
they just, he didn't, they, there's no point in, you know, seeing much from him at AAA if he shows he's ready. So yeah, I can't wait to see his outings in Biloxi. Please let's get that center field camera and then go a Mizorowski start to Craig Yoho in the bridge. I don't know a whole lot like where the rest of the minor league, you know, prospect reliever world is. Like, you know, everyone pays, you know, you just pay attention to the starters.
Right.
But like, there's an argument here at the very least for the best relief only pitching prospect in baseball, like guys that you're not even thinking of as starters. There's certainly a case given those numbers.
Here's what I don't understand. He's 23 years old, getting drafted out of Indiana in this 2023 draft that I've fallen in love with. And so it makes sense that he would sign. He's an older player, but he had multiple years of eligibility left because he had so many injuries. He signs for $10,000, which is ridiculously below slot value. Like, that's not even in the ballpark of slot value. Now, obviously, a lot of these guys agree to deals. We could talk about the slot value system, but $10K is afterthought money. And I don't understand how that's possible. How did the Brewers get a guy for $10,000, a guy who is like big league ready soon? I mean, did they work a miracle, or is something missing that I don't understand? Even Andy Spencer?
I honestly don't. I mean, the thing is, if he would have gotten drafted after the 10th round, he could have signed for almost $150,000 without counting towards any bonus pool. So you would think somebody in his spot would have been able to put himself in that position. It makes me wonder, and I've wondered this with older college pitchers sometimes, if it's a matter of being in the Brewers system, a system that does give a lot of chances to older pitching prospects, to a system that develops their pitchers really well. I wonder if that played a part in it, because otherwise I was wondering the same thing even when he signed, because he was a name that was kind of interesting to me going into the draft. So I did not expect to see 10,000 for him.
I don't know the full answer either, but I will say this. Ginger Polson, the Brewers scout in that area, is pretty damn good. Like they find guys in that area that other teams just aren't on. And you know, they did a lot of work with Yoho, and I'm gonna guess that you got some idea of, you know, like what the kid wants at that point in his career. And you don't go pitching the pros for 10,000, you know, pitching the minor leagues for 10,000 if you don't want to. And like, there's probably a little bit of betting on yourself there as well. And it's just kind of crazy though. You look at the whole picture, like a guy with, you know, that stuff, just no one else really being interested in, it's a unique situation.
There are a lot of guys that we're just not going to have time to spend on because they're far enough away. You know, Dettori is a guy that you mentioned. Bishop Letson is a pitcher that we've talked about. Juan Baez, kind of a diminutive infielder who's making a name for himself at A-ball a little bit this year. Luke Adams. These are guys who are a little bit further away, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on them. But I want to know if there's anybody else that we should acknowledge as someone who could help the Brewers this year. This could be your opportunity, Kurt, to talk about Wes Clark, our guy, our power hitting possible catcher first base combo that's out there. Mike Bovee, I think, is probably more than a year away at this point, but he had a very eye popping start to his season this year. I don't know if there's really anybody else that we want to mention. So, Kurt, who needs to be said here before we wrap this up?
Yeah, the only other name, like, for guys this year, I would say is Isaac Collins, maybe. I could see, I don't know, he might be a 40-man guy this offseason as well. He's a guy the Brewers stole in the Triple A phase of the Rule 5 draft a couple years ago from, I think, the Rockies. And he's, like, playing pretty well at Triple A right now and kind of, like, has surprisingly, in my eyes, projected as like a utility bench bat in the big leagues, which is certainly a valuable role. And I did not see that coming at all, but that's pretty like, that's kind of it in my eyes, unless, you know, you got some more in your mind, Spencer.
Only name that I could maybe see helping at some point is Chad Patrick, the guy they got for Abraham Toro. He's been getting a lot more whiffs than I would have expected him to. And let's look. He's got his cutter as his primary pitch, and it's got a whiff rate of 33%, which is pretty good. His four seam doesn't have great qualities, but he's got a 36% whiff rate on it, which is very, very high for a four seamer. And then his slider has a 40% whiff rate too. So three pitches that he gets a decent amount of swing and miss on. He hasn't had a ton of hard contact against any of his pitches because he does throw a sinker and a changeup as well, but he's more low 90s. It would probably be just a starter depth type thing where he comes up and makes a start or two, but more interesting than I expected him to be coming into the season.
Well, we've talked enough about prospects. I would say we've had full length episode. I swore
to these guys be like 20 to 25 minutes. Can we talk enough about prospects?
That's the nice thing about this organization is we could probably talk for a lot longer, but I know Spencer, by the way, is this still a top five organization now that they've graduated Jackson Chourio and Robert Gasser? Are they now are they still a top 10 at least, do you think?
I think they're probably still top 10. Five, I would doubt, but it's very deep. And there's still some top heavy guys like Cairo, even though he's hurt, and Mizorowski. And yeah. They still have some of those names that'll pop out and make evaluators push them towards the top of the list too. So, yeah, it'll be mostly based on depth, though.
All right. Well, this is hopefully you've enjoyed this. I'm going to move now to my interview with Jeff Hem of the Nashville Sound. So he talked a little bit more about the AAA level, some prospect talk, but a lot beyond that as well, like the challenge system stuff, which I found really, really interesting. But thank you, Spencer Michaelis, for joining us. He is our special guest again. You can find his writing at Brewer Fanatic. Any place else you want to plug since you were kind enough to join us?
No, I mean, we, Jack Stern and I have the Brewer Fanatic podcast, not to it's competition, I know, but
oh no, it's right. I know it's fine.
but yeah, we record that every Thursday and post that on Friday morning. So you can check that out. I'll be doing that right after this.
Perfect. Kurt and I will be back on Monday in the usual places here where we are talking about this Cubs series and some White Sox while we're at it. A lot of Chicago this week, Kurt. I don't know how you're feeling about that, but a lot of Chicago. A
lot of Chicago.
Yes.
At least here. It's here. It's Chicago, but it's here.
Yes. Yes. The big city in little tiny Milwaukee beating up on the big boys. It's been a good week so far. We'll see where it's at here through the weekend. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Micro Brew. Now here's Jeff Hem. Thanks for joining us, everybody. My guest is Jeff Hem. You may know him as the play-by-play announcer for the Nashville Sounds. If you're a follower of minor league baseball, that of course is the AAA affiliate of the Milwaukee Brewers. A lot of players who've come through the Sounds are now with Milwaukee, and some of the players with Milwaukee end up in Nashville at points in the season. And Jeff Hem gets to see it all. Jeff, we're going to start. I want to start with you can give me the brief origin story. That would be kind of a good. I know you went to Iowa. I know that you're a Chicagoland guy, so you may or may not want to reveal just how deeply invested you were in the Chicago Cubs growing up. that is totally up to you, but you give me a little bit of background on how you ended up where you are right now.
Well, JR, thanks for having me. It's good to chat with you. I did grow up going to both Cubs and White Sox games. Oh, okay. I've got different family members who are on both sides of that fence. And so
Brewers fans hate both parties, just so you know. There's lots of hatred.
No, I totally understand. And, you know, it's interesting then when you get into working in professional sports in whatever capacity, the fandom part really goes away. That part of your life is always there, but it's not at the forefront. If for no other reason, you start watching the team you're covering, and you, even if you wanted to, there are other teams that you don't have time to watch. And then you become a fan because you see how hard the players work in this, especially when they're in the minor leagues and when they're in AAA and they're trying to get to the big leagues or back to the big leagues. You see how hard they work. It's only natural to want to root for them. And so in my time with the Sounds, and I've been with the team since 2012, the first 3 years, we were a Brewers affiliate back then. That was the end of what turned out to be a 10-year run the Sounds had with Milwaukee. Then the Sounds were an A's affiliate for 4 years. And I had already known the A's a little bit from my first full-time job in this industry with the Kane County Cougars back in the Midwest League. We were an A's affiliate a lot when I was there. So I was already familiar with the A's when the Sounds had that relationship. And I had some friendships there. And I naturally became a quote-unquote fan of the A's just because you get to know so many of the people. And even though I didn't grow up in Oakland, you know the people who were trying to become Oakland A's from being with the Sounds. So naturally, you're going to root for them. Then in 2019, the Sounds were AAA for the Rangers. Same thing. You sort of like, well, all right, well, I like some of these people. I want them to do well. So there were some former Sounds involved last year when the Rangers won the World Series. And even though I wasn't trying to pretend that I was a longtime diehard Rangers fan, you're happy for the success of some of those people that you've gotten to know. And now these last few years, we've been back with the Brewers, which has felt like a glove that always fit really well. The relationship is very strong, it feels like, between Nashville and the Brewers. And so there are countless people within the Brewers organization that you get to know well, you're rooting for them. And so the fandom part of it is interesting when you're in the industry, because it does evolve based on who you're around and who you end up rooting for, a lot of the people that you're covering. So I'm not going to pretend to be the same type of Brewers fan that somebody who was born in Waukesha and went to Brewers games when they were 8 years old would have. That's a different fandom that I have. But there's no doubt that when you cover a team every day and they're going up to play for the Brewers, you want the Brewers to do well, and you do in some sense become a fan of that team. So that's kind of the evolution of young me into professional, and the teams that you're around really dictate what you're paying attention to. And then by default, you end up rooting for those teams.
Yeah. The fact that you are not someone who lives in Wisconsin, can pronounce Waukesha perfectly is already a point in your favor, Jeff. So I'm sure Brewers fans are happy to have had you for as long as they have had, you know. So you mentioned you've been there since 2012. So that's 12 years in one place. I know you did get a chance to call a couple Oakland Athletics games. So you have at least had that cup of coffee, so to speak, in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. My perception of broadcasting in the minor leagues, a lot of movement, a lot of hustle, a lot of poorly paying jobs to just, you know, bad bus rides to try to build yourself up to get to this point. Is it unusual for someone to be in one spot for as long as you have, for more than a decade, and kind of have that relationship to Nashville that, you know, I guess, I don't know. I know Chris Merring with the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers. He's been there forever. Yeah. So maybe it's more common than I think. How would you describe that?
Well, a lot of it depends on the situation that you're in. I've been very fortunate. When I was in Kane County, I was there for 7 years. That's where I'm from. That's my home county. Mm-hmm. I grew up in that area. And so when I got that job, I had family nearby. You know, my wife is from, my now wife at the time, girlfriend and then fiance, was from that same area. So, and Kane County was a great operation. They had broadcasters go, in some cases, directly from there to the big leagues. Dave Wills, Scott Fransky, Wayne Randazzo, who's now with the Angels, came through that. So there was a nice broadcast lineage there that I felt like, all right, I'm with an organization that knows what they're doing. It seems pretty adept at identifying good people to try to call their games. So I felt to some degree sort of honored to have that job. And it was just a very convenient spot for me away from the job itself. And so I didn't feel like, all right, I've got to try to get to high A now as a broadcaster, just to say I'm one step closer to the major league. So I was fortunate to be in a great spot where I was a little bit more selective in what I pursued as those next opportunities. A lot of it was double A opportunities or triple A opportunities. And I got very fortunate in 2012 to get a job with the Sounds. There was no guarantee at that time that the Sounds 3 years later would get a new ballpark, which has turned out to be very successful. The city has grown incredibly. And so again, I kind of lucked my way, because in this industry, to your point, like, you can't always choose where the openings are going to come. And you certainly can't choose sometimes when you're the guy that the team wants to hire. So I've been very fortunate to be in two spots where I've enjoyed it and not felt like I've got to find a way to get out of here and I'll take whatever I can get because I just want to get out of here. So that's part of why I feel like I've been able to have some longevity in the two organizations that I've been with, just because I happened to be hired by two that turned out to be, for multiple reasons, very great situations. And I can think back to other minor league broadcasting jobs that I applied for and didn't get. And at the time, you're disappointed. Years later, you might even go to some of those cities and you're like, well, that was a blessing in disguise that I ended up not getting that job. So I feel very fortunate. I love Nashville. We love the city. I'm here year round. My family loves it. It's geographically close to a lot of different people in my life that I still want to be close to. It's a great city. So I just feel very fortunate the way it's worked out in the spots that have happened to be my stops on this journey.
What is your job aside from the broadcasting? I know a lot of guys in your shoes have front office responsibilities. It isn't just what the public might see, although it's more than, you know, 10 years ago, maybe it was harder to even hear that voice of minor league baseball outside of the community, you know, like everything's streamed and available online. So maybe there's more to it now than there was before, but what is your job description, I guess?
Yeah. So sometimes in season, but really the main off season responsibility is I'm part of our corporate partnerships team. So I'm trying to help us gather sponsors for the team and advertising partners and marketing partners. That's the main off season role. There are occasional speaking engagements and appearances and things that I'm helping out with. If there's a press conference of some sort or something that's happening at the ballpark that I might be an MC for, but most of the time, the off-season role is more helping the team bring in the revenue, which helps then facilitate the other parts of the job that you're more passionate about, which is the broadcasting side of things. So for me, that's what I'm doing in the off-season. Not everybody is full-time year-round. Some guys don't want to be. Some people are seasonal. It allows them to do other things in the off-season. I do some football and basketball broadcasting in addition to being with the Sounds in the off season, but it's nothing where I can't do both. So it works out for me individually to have the role that I have with this team. But again, like, you could pull 10 different AAA broadcasters and ask them that same question. You might get to a degree 10 different answers based on the other responsibilities and whether they're there in the off season or whether they're seasonal.
Nashville isn't completely novel as a really major city with a AAA team. I realize, you know, there's Columbus, Indianapolis comes to mind, Austin. I mean, there are cities like this, but it is a little unusual when you think of minor league baseball. You think of smaller cities sort of embracing the local team. I'm curious kind of what the relationship is between Nashville and the Sounds. We have sort of an analog here in Milwaukee as the Nashville Predators minor league hockey team, but hockey is a little more niche. It's a little harder to gauge, I would say, than baseball. So how do you, you know, over your 12 years, what sort of have you seen the relationship between Nashville and the Sounds?
The connection has really grown and grown. I think what the Sounds do a great job of as a front office and a ticket sales and a marketing outreach component is making sure that we have something for every type of fan. And everybody might say that, and that's really easy to say and kind of generic, but truly in our market with our situation and the competitors we have here in town, we have to have something for everyone. And we've got Sounds fans who've been following the team almost from its inception in 1978, who they come every game and they want to watch every pitch and they are locked into the baseball. And then you have other folks who are going to come to the game and they're going to be out in our right field bar area. It's called the Bandbox. It's very popular. It's its own little ecosystem out there. And some of those folks never really watch a single pitch that night. And that's okay too. And then you want the families who just want a safe place for their kids to run around, and the beer is cold, the hot dogs taste good, the fireworks are impressive. And we want those people too. So I think what helps the Sounds be number one or near number one these last few years in total minor league home attendance is truly being able to create something where anybody in this market would think it's a fun place and a good idea to go to a game because they can associate it with something that they're looking for. And that has to cast a pretty wide net in order to be a successful minor league team. It's a big market, so you've got a lot of potential people who could come to games, but they've also got a lot of other things they could choose to do mm-hmm. with some of that money. And so we want to make sure that they feel welcome and that there's something that they can identify with, whether it's hardcore baseball, a little bit of baseball, or somewhere in between. And I think the Sounds do a good job of that. And that's why the team and the ballpark and the reputation of the organization has grown to the success that it has.
How has the prospect of Nashville getting a major league team, you know, that's been discussed among other possible landing spots for an expansion team, how has that affected you or affected the organization at all? If at all, maybe not.
Yeah, it doesn't really feel like it's affected it. I mean, we get asked about it and we don't know what that's ever going to look like. I think the biggest thing we feel is that's a compliment to what the Sounds have done. Mm-hmm. If people think somewhere down the road that's at all possible, that's probably because the Sounds have done a good job at what we've accomplished. And I think any other markets that come up in some of those conversations, most of them have successful AAA franchises in those cities. And so it makes it easier to think maybe that could happen someday. So we take it as a compliment. It really has zero to do with anything in the day-to-day business. Who knows whatever happens well down the road, if anything, but it really doesn't day-to-day affect what we do. If anything, it's just a compliment. It's almost a positive association because it means we're doing something right if people think something like that could ever work here.
As we get closer to talking about some of the individual players that I just wanted to ask you briefly about, it kind of ties into this challenge system that I know a lot of major league fans are clamoring for, the idea of an automated ball strike zone or even a challenge system. Both have existed in the minor leagues. And I think about a guy like Tyler Black, who will be a Brewer at some point very soon permanently, and it was briefly this year, and how maybe there is a little bit of a transition to go from someone who knows the strike zone so well and knows what's supposed to be called, and mm-hmm. then get to the major leagues, and you have to feel it out more. It's a little more, you know, it's just not as concrete as it would be in the minor leagues. That's just one thing that's rattling around my head. But more than that, I'm curious, as someone who has seen it as much as anybody, what your thoughts are on the automated strike system, and if there are unintended consequences you can perceive, or if it's as great as it sounds, you know, the utopian world that it sounds like. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, when Tyler Black went up, I knew at least once or twice, well, however long he was going to be up there, he was going to strike out looking at some point on a pitch that is just no doubt a ball down here that they were going to call a strike up there. I knew it was going to happen, and it did. He's such a disciplined hitter and an impressive hitter to watch, and he's got such a bright future. You're right to distinguish that there are two different components that we're seeing down here. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in our six-game series, they use the automatic ball strike system where the home plate umpire is not calling anything. He's literally or she getting a device that is telling them what the computer thinks it was or says it was. Now, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday game, that same system is in place, but it doesn't relay anything to the plate umpire unless someone has challenged a ball or a strike call. I can tell you, we saw this at the tail end of 2022 in our league. Charlotte was the only one that had it. So we went to Charlotte late in 22 and saw the challenge system only. Then all of last year, it was Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, ABS, Friday, Saturday, Sunday challenge. That same format is now in place this year. So I've seen this for about a year and a half now. And if you want to know what I think, I'm happy to share it. But I can, what I think is even more telling, because I'm asking anybody that I interview, or not even interview, but just chatting with, whether that's an executive, a manager, a pitching coach, a hitting coach, the hitters, the catcher. I've taken like this unofficial poll over the last year and a half. There's not a single person that has preferred just the ABS over the challenge system. Everybody loves the challenge system. And I do too. What I don't like about the ABS and what I have a hard time believing would ever translate to MLB is just the catcher's receiving doesn't matter anymore. Every ABS game, there's one or two pitches that just are received awkwardly by the catcher. And so we're wired to think, well, that's a ball. He had to struggle to catch it. Yeah. And there might be a strike call out of it. And you look at the little system on the computer, and sure enough, it apparently grabbed the outside corner. There's value in catching framing and how hard the catchers work and how well they're compensated at the big league level for being good receivers. You wipe that out with the ABS. And I just find it hard to believe that MLB would ever get to a point where they would want to just eradicate that part of the game. Because it does, if the ball goes through the strike zone, it's a strike. And it literally does not matter how the catcher receives it. He didn't have to catch it. He could just let it go to the backstop if nobody's on base, and it's going to call what it's going to call. The challenge system is truly has the best of all worlds. And I can do an hour on this. I'm passionate about it because I think it's so great. I really do. And it's not just me. Everybody I've asked, even people you think might not like the challenge system, whether they're a pitcher they feel is being hurt by it or a catcher or a hitter, everybody likes it. Everybody also likes the human component of the plate umpire still being involved. What we all want to avoid, of course, is bases loaded, ninth inning, some egregious call that we all know was out of the zone and a guy called a strike because umpires are human too. You want to have recourse for that. This provides that. It's also quick. There's strategy to it too. The pitcher and catcher have to ask for it, and they have to ask for it right away if they feel a ball was a strike, or if the batter thinks a strike was a ball, the batter has to ask for it right away. There's no looking to the dugout. Hey, the manager's tipping his hat like, yeah, challenge that. If the umpire thinks you're getting help as the hitter, pitcher, or catcher, he or she will not allow the challenge to proceed. So it's quick. There's strategy to it. We've seen a lot of games where teams early on are burning challenges like they've got unlimited. And then by the fifth inning, they're out. And then in the seventh inning, there's that pitch where you can tell by their reaction they would love to challenge it, and they're out of challenges. So there's strategy to it. Then they show it up on the video board, so everybody in the ballpark can see how close it was. So everybody's on the same page. And there are so many lost challenges that if I'm Major League Baseball and I'm wanting to defend my umpires, who are really good, I think we would all agree most umpires most of the time are outstanding at what they do. There are a lot of challenges that are lost by the teams where the umpire was proven right. So I just don't see a downside to the challenge system. It was so clear to everyone that I asked last year that I was optimistic going into this year. They would say, all right, no more ABS. We're just going 100% of the time to the challenge system. They're still doing the 50-50. So clearly MLB still wants to get feedback and data from it. Yeah. But there's nothing, in my opinion, to dislike about the challenge system. And then the catcher's receiving skills and their ability to make something look like a ball or a strike and pull it back in. That's all wired into this. And so there's no downside. The umpires are still shown to be really good. There's recourse if they make a mistake, because they will. There's strategy to it. It's fun. They show it up on the video board. I'm waiting for that mass email we all get that it's like, hey, we're going to the challenge system all the time, because everyone I've asked would be like, well, we should have gone to that long ago. So,
man, there's so much there. That is so interesting. I'm even struck by, to what degree do the aesthetics of baseball matter when you're talking about the receiving? Like, would we be frustrated with a game if the catcher was sloppy and wasn't catching them in the zone and they were still strikes and balls, if that would throw people off enough, even though it doesn't really matter, but it does in the way we consume and watch baseball. So I'm interested in that part of it. There's so much.
You're right. What some people have told me is that they've used the word sterile, that the ABS games feel kind of sterile because there's just the umpire's not calling it. So the batter like wants to have that moment of like, wait a minute, you can't. And then they're like, oh yeah, you didn't even call that. The computer called it. And they walk away. You think some people are gonna be like, oh, I'd love the ABS. These umpires aren't good enough. Like, they're missing calls. Like, even the people who you'd think might have that opinion are like, well, I'm not one to get rid of the human element of this. And it's like, okay, that's interesting to hear. And I think a lot of people feel that way. I think umpires are really good. If you're giving a few opportunities for recourse in a game with some strategy to it, to me, that feels like the best of all worlds. And then it helps the umpires not be the story, because no one, years later is going to think, remember that challenge overturn? They're just going to think, oh, that team won the game. And when they might have won because a key call got overturned. But like, the story is not the controversial call that you look later on the postgame show and it's way out of the zone. And how could they call that a strike? Like, the umpires stop being the story then, which is also a win, I think, for everybody. Umpires just want the calls to be right too. So it's just, I'll stop because I know this is not a, what do you think of the challenge system podcast, but I've seen enough. It's very clear to me, and it's not just me, it's everybody that I've asked. The challenge system just overwhelmingly is getting the far more positive feedback.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask you about a few current Nashville Sounds players that the Brewers would be interested in knowing a little more about. I know you're not into like talent evaluation necessarily, but obviously you see these guys. And I'm going to start with three pitchers who actually haven't had a great run thus far, being Aaron Ashby, Carlos Rodriguez, and Tyler Wasner. Now, Tyler Wasner's kind of set off to the side here. He's pretty new to the Sounds, you know, still developing. I'm pretty excited about him. And I know that the Brewers fans, probably most of them probably haven't even gotten to know his name yet. But Carlos Rodriguez is one of the minor league pitchers of the year last year for the Brewers and has struggled at AAA this year. And Aaron Ashby, of course, has been with the Brewers, had this really bummer of a shoulder surgery, and has really, really struggled. And I'd be curious just what your thoughts on all three of those guys are. I know they're very different cases, but what have you seen when you see those three guys pitch?
Yeah, I think Wasner has a very bright future. I mean, mid-90s with a power sinker. Just talking to him a little bit as I have so far, he seems like a very confident kid and a very focused and, you know, just not going to back down to anything kind of a kid. Just, I'm going to go out there and I'm just going to try to zip it by somebody just out of confidence, knowing that his stuff can play. I think a lot of times it's very similar, in my opinion, to a AAA guy going up to the big leagues. It's not a surprise if there's a little bit of a feeling out period, mm-hmm. Whether that's nerves, whether that's just getting used to a different style or quality of hitters, in the case of we're talking pitching here, hitters who have seen a lot, so they're not going to chase something that batters might have chased at AA. The first couple for Wasner were rough, and you know, getting used to the ABS is a whole conversation in and of itself, because pitchers are not pitching with that in AA, and it is a tight zone with the ABS. It is cut and dried. It's all or nothing, ball or strike. And so if you're struggling and you're nervous and you're starting to walk some guys at AAA, the ABS is not going to change for you. And so I think there was part of that getting used to it for Wasner, but his last couple have been much better. He had a dominant outing last week in Jacksonville, where I talked to him afterward and he felt like, all right, that's who I am. And, you know, it really felt like kind of a deep breath, like I've settled into AAA moment for him. Bright, very bright future. And I think now that he's got a little bit of AAA time under his belt, you know, I think great days ahead for him. Similar to Carlos Rodriguez. I mean, he was here for one start at the end of last year as kind of a recognition, a reward for the season he'd put together. And then starting here, he also told me he identified a small mechanical component that got out of whack early in the year. He and pitching coach Jeremy Accardo identified something that they corrected. And it seems to have worked, because if you look at Carlos's last, he's won his last four starts. The last two have been quality starts. The last three overall have been really good. I think the one exception was like five innings of one run ball. He's been terrific lately. So he again seems to have found something mechanically. And I also would imagine, as a guy who doesn't throw 99, and is known for his good command, has started to figure out what the ABS is going to give and not give. And so it was interesting, like Wasner's first three starts were all in the ABS. He finally last weekend got to pitch in the challenge game. And so the ABS, being as unforgiving as it is, just was the cycle of his spot in the rotation was always coming around in the early part of the week. Ashby, I am so impressed by Aaron Ashby. He joined me on my pregame show the other day. He's so open about and aware of where he is in this road back. And he is understandably, like I'm sure a lot of Brewers fans, feeling impatient, feeling like, where's my old velocity? Where's my old command? It's still coming back for him. But he's also, I would tell Brewers fans, very encouraged by where he's at, because he came to us late last year on a rehab assignment. And you could tell it was taking physically everything he had to just get upper 80s on his velocity. Like it just wasn't there yet in the recovery. He now would tell you, hey, I'm a free and easy 93, 94. So I'm not 96, 97 like I was in 2022, but I'm not giving it everything I've got in the same way I had to late last year. And I'm getting readings that are inching closer to where I used to be. So he is really working through it. I mean, I can't imagine how frustrating last year was, and now to come back this year and to not be back up there yet and not feel like he's really back, but he is moving in the right direction. I think with the, you know, I wonder this, I haven't asked Aaron this, and I am not a medical person, but I wonder, the Tommy John surgery has such a well-known reputation of being clear cut. Here's the recovery. Here's when you should be back. You're probably going to throw harder. Like, it's just a known comeback. And I feel like some of the shoulder ones have more gray area. And so in my mind, there's this expectation of like, he missed all of last year. Now he's back. It should look the same, but it, you know, maybe that particular shoulder injury that he dealt with is just creating a little bit longer road back. And so on the one hand, it's like, it doesn't look right that he's not back to his old form, but it's also understandable that like, look, this might take longer than it did for other guys or for other injuries or for other parts of the arm. So it's really easy to think what's wrong with Ashby. Well, nothing is wrong. In my opinion, it's just still taking some time for him to fully get the feel and command back. He's gotten a lot of swing and miss in his last couple outings. He's been in the strike zone a lot more, especially two outings ago. He had a game in Durham that I know he was very encouraged by. So it's coming, but it's easy for all of us, and I can't imagine how it feels for Aaron, to feel like something should have happened by now. But I don't know that that's the case. I think it's just we feel like that should be the case, and we're projecting that there should be 97 miles an hour and Ashby should be in the big leagues again with the Brewers because he's got that type of potential and he's proven to be that type of pitcher when he's fully back.
And then on the offensive side, Tyler Black is a guy that Brewers fans got to know a little bit. You know, he struggled a little bit. We talked maybe about the challenge system even playing into that. But what can Brewers fans expect when he's really like the fully realized version of himself?
He's just such a disciplined hitter and a tough out. I mean, he just, even on a night where you think he's going to go 0-for-5. He ends up with this opposite field line drive single in the eighth inning. Like it's on there. And there it is. There's another hit for Black. He's a very professional hitter with his mindset and his knowledge of what the zone is. So he just doesn't get fooled very much. He doesn't chase very much, gets a lot of hard contact. I think he's got all the tools, especially offensively, to be a productive major league hitter, just because he's not this all or nothing. Well, he hit it 400 feet because he made contact and the other three at bats were strikeouts. He's a get on base guy. He's an extra base hit, hit it in the gap. He's got the speed that the Brewers love to mix in with some of the other personnel they have up there. So he was up there for such a brief time too. And again, like it's, Robert Gasser made his first two starts look really like this is really easy. And this is, you know, Gasser's like the next Cy Young Award winner based on the first two starts. There's usually an adjustment period somewhere along the way. Some guys have it right away. Some guys have to counter adjust after the opposition adjusts. So it's just not linear for anybody. Tyler is back down here playing every day, getting his at bats, and I have no doubt the Brewers would have no problem feeling confident if they had to call on him again sometime soon.
All right. Last question. If there's anything else that Brewers fans should know about the Nashville Sounds, I imagine most fans don't spend a lot of time thinking about the Nashville Sounds, but for those who follow the minor leagues and the Brewers have this one of the best minor league systems in baseball right now, there is a little more attention. So anything else Brewers fans should know?
I think there's a lot of potential major league contribution from a lot of different parts of this roster. Now that doesn't mean that they're all going to be big league all-stars or they're all going to be with the Brewers for 10 years, but the Brewers have no shortage of options down here really in any position department. And so I think, you know, the Brewers fans, like a lot of the names you asked me about, they might know those names and maybe they don't know many others, but in that many others category, there are guys who could help them this year. And so I think it's fun to monitor. For me, it's fun to monitor a first place team up there and to see what's down here and to know, oh, if they needed a left-handed bat for a week, if they needed another reliever in the bullpen, they needed a long man, they needed a starter, like this team is pretty well covered down here to help facilitate, whether it's long-term for a guy who goes up and stays or somebody who can help fill a hole in the short term. We've already seen the Brewers have to use the Sounds a lot. There's more down here that can help. And I think that should be encouraging for Brewers fans to know. And even down at Double A, there's more coming too. So I'm excited about, if we were having this conversation in August, I'm excited about what the Sounds might look like then, just because I do think the system is in a well-stocked position right now.
Yeah. He's Jeff Hem, voice of the Nashville Sounds, the Brewers AAA affiliate. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. We'll be listening. We'll be following along as the season goes along. Appreciate it.
Thanks, JR. Happy to be with you.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,